Welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I'm Annie Waldman, an education reporter here at ProPublica, and today we're speaking with Corey Turner, an education reporter and editor at NPR. It is no secret that there are vast disparities in school funding across the country, with the majority of the school districts receiving a large share of their funding from local property tax. Where you go to school really matters. Over decades, this funding divide has forged deep educational inequities, even though by law, all students, regardless of who or where they are, should have the same opportunities to a quality education. Many families, advocates, and experts say poor schools need better funding. But can more money actually fix America's impoverished schools? Turner spent over 6 months working with a team of 20 NPR member stations trying to find this out. Corey, thanks for taking time to speak with us.
Thanks for having me, Annie.
Great. So why don't we begin with you telling us a little bit about how you began your series on school money. Many people understand that school funding is a key issue and leads to disparities. So why did you realize that this needed to be investigated now?
The complicated answer, I'll try not to make it too complicated, is we here at the NPR Ed team, since the beginning of the team 2 years ago, we've tried really hard to reach out to member station education reporters and to create a kind of professional family of ed journalists. Like, we share ideas, we workshop ideas, we actually host a regular weekly call where we just talk shop, basically. And it happened on a call maybe 6-8 months ago. One of the reporters, and I can't remember if it was Sam Zeff in Kansas or Laura Eisensee in Houston, because they both have school funding lawsuits, but one of them, we talked around and said, you know, what we're working on, and one of them said, well, we've got a big school funding lawsuit. And the moment either Sam or Laura said that, like, everybody else on the call said, oh, yeah, you know, either they'd done it already, or they were themselves in the middle of covering it, or they could easily see one coming on the horizon because of things that have been happening politically in their state. And that was just a big moment for me. I didn't know much about school funding lawsuits. I didn't know what was happening in Kansas or Texas. And so I started doing my homework, and I realized these things are really common. You know, some 45 states have had school funding lawsuits. And it also became very clear to me very quickly that these lawsuits are a symptom of a much broader ailment, which is how we pay for our schools and why it is that school money is so inequitable in so many different places, which, again, as we explained in the reporting, not every time, but quite often boils down to disparities in local property tax revenue.
This is something that a lot of Americans are actually very aware of. Even last year, for the 10th year in a row, a Gallup poll found that Americans view a lack of financial support as the biggest problem facing local public schools. But it's not as simple as a narrative as what you found. Some school districts are able to spend lots more than others, and sometimes these districts can be right next to those that are severely lacking in funds. So I'm curious, what kind of striking disparities did you and your team stumble upon in your reporting?
As part of our first week's reporting, our data visualization team did something really special. They created a school spending map, a per-student spending map for representing just about every district in the nation. It's easy to see on the map, you know, spending in New York is consistently high. Spending in Wyoming is consistently high for very different reasons, but it's consistently high. But there are lots of really interesting states like Illinois and actually big chunks of the Midwest, where there are districts all over the spending map, and sometimes they're right next door to each other. And again, like, I had been reporting it, I had been editing it, like, I knew this, but looking at the map, it was just made so clear to me that there's just a lot of variation just baked right into the system, and variation is a kind word for inequity in lots of cases. There's one example we lead off the reporting with. The week one story starts off with this comparison of two districts that really aren't far apart at all, maybe an hour's drive, one on the north side of Chicago, north of Chicago, the other just south of Chicago. And one district spends roughly, I think it was $9,000 per student, and the other is around $28,000 per student. And, you know, again, those two schools are just an hour apart. And we found variation like that in lots of places all over the country.
You know, one of the most striking moments in your series takes us to Sumter County, Alabama, where you found one school that's so underfunded that there's really not much money there for the much-needed repairs. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how your reporter found this school and stumbled on this story.
Yeah, so that reporter was Dan Carson from Birmingham. He's based in Birmingham. The moment we started talking about school funding, he mentioned Sumter County. The interesting thing to me is the tape that I used from Dan in my interview that I did on Morning Edition was not actually in his radio story. I've been talking back and forth with Dan, and I remember when he told me, he said, "Man, I just got this tour of this school, and you're just not going to believe what I found." And I was riveted in his description of it to me, and then we worked on his radio story, and we just didn't end up using that tape. And I finally circled back to him. I said, "Can you just send me that whole? I want that whole moment. I want, you know, send me all that tape." And once I listened to it, I thought, "Gosh, this is a really powerful moment because it's, you know, it's his gut reaction, not as a reporter or a journalist necessarily, but just, you know, as a citizen walking into what was once a classroom, but now has, you know, mold in the ceiling and buckets on the floor to catch rainwater."
Here he is visiting a former classroom. Emphasis on former.
Yeah, you can smell the mold in here. Huh. It floods when it rains in here?
Well, oh, the floor's all... Well, not flood, but, you can tell it's a steady leak that comes down.
Oh, is this is the catch, the water?
And for me, that's what was so powerful about that moment, is you can just hear in Dan's voice, and Dan's a very level guy. He is not super reactive. He's a very good journalist, but you can still hear in his voice, it's like, huh, you know, looking around and just can't quite believe that this is the scene in a school. And it's a classroom that they're not using anymore, presumably because they can't. But right after that cut of tape, you can hear the principal say, "You know, I'd love to be able to use this room. I'd love to be able to make it a computer lab. But as you can tell, I can't do a thing with it."
Mm. So ultimately, how did these school funding disparities come to exist? In your report, you pegged it to a unexpected character, Satan. You wouldn't expect it. Well, I definitely didn't expect it. But why would the devil be so central to the contemporary story of disparities in school spending?
I mean, so to be honest, I used the old deluder Satan law, which was, I believe, goes back to 1647, Massachusetts Bay Colony. I used it as a way into talking about not just how we pay for schools, but how we think of our obligation to pay for schools. Because for me, having spent roughly 6 months of my life working on this project, you know, people ask me, like, "What did you learn? What did you learn? Like, what's the fix?" And for me, the fix is not one simple financial change, one simple policy wand you can wave. For me, it really goes back to the beginning of school funding and the old deluder Satan law, when the Massachusetts Bay colonists basically said, "Look, if we want every child to be able to read the Bible, then every child needs to be able to read. It is in the best interest of the colony that every child be taught to read. And as such, any village of 50 or more people needs to pay up for a teacher." I mean, you can see it in the law, too. They're not just talking to parents. They're talking to everybody. It was captured in law. It was codified in law, this idea that educating the colony's children, or you can extrapolate to today, the nation's children, is in the best interests of all citizens. That's what so interested me with the old deluder Satan law, or as it's known now.
And so nearly 370 years later, we're still using this model of, paraphrasing here, but local public good, local public responsibility.
Well, and that's the challenge, is that we still have, at least in terms of funding, a fairly local system. And I know education has always been about local control. And, you know, I hesitate to call that a problem, because I think there are obviously lots of really important benefits to local control. I mean, any principal or superintendent will tell you, "Look, we know better how to spend the money we have on the students that we have than anyone at the federal level will ever be able to understand. You know, they know their kids better than anyone." But the challenge is when so much of that funding depends on local affluence and local school district lines and is informed, you know, in a big way by old segregationist housing policy. this is the nation we live in. And the fact is, there are an awful lot of school districts that are low-wealth, low-income districts, and they just don't have the same capacity to fundraise as other more affluent districts. And that's just a fact. Some states have been very progressive about reckoning with that and using state dollars collected at the state level to help offset some, if not much, of that imbalance. But lots of other states just haven't done much, if anything, about it.
In your reporting, you found that North Carolina is one of those states that really stepped in and helped provide extra school funding. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So North Carolina is a really interesting case because if you look at overall school funding in North Carolina, it's still pretty low. It's a complicated story in terms of funding, but what really caught my interest in North Carolina and the interest of our reporter, Lisa Wharf, is that North Carolina is also one of these states that hosted a really long, protracted school funding battle in its courts. And ultimately, one trial judge, I believe his name is Howard Manning, was basically assigned to oversee this long-running lawsuit. When I say long-running, I mean, I think trying to figure out how long, it was called Leandro, it lasted, I think, 2 decades. It may still be ongoing. These things are really hard to keep track of because they sort of pop up again and again. It's like a car needs maintenance. But in North Carolina, what was so interesting is basically this judge, Howard Manning, did a lot of homework, bounced back and forth with the state over a long period of time, basically asking, is school funding here good enough? And basically, he came to the conclusion that, yes, for most kids it is, but for what he called at-risk kids, or what I often call disadvantaged kids, kids living in poverty, kids who are most likely to drop out, kids learning English as a second language, he said, we're not doing a good enough job. And what's really interesting about what Manning and the state came to terms with, really, is the idea that the best way to fix that, the best intervention that the state could pay for, was high-quality preschool. And I think there are lots of very smart people in this country who would agree with him on that. There's considerable debate over what constitutes high quality or how hard it is to scale up high quality once you're talking about, you know, state level. I mean, we saw recently in Tennessee their supposedly high-quality pre-K program just did not do well at all. But in North Carolina, they started offering high-quality pre-K to, I think at its peak several years ago, it was 30, 35,000 kids. Cost a lot of money, which they subsidized in large part, I think, by a lottery. But it's just a really interesting example of a state using a very specific intervention to support its disadvantaged kids.
So you also said that there is another side to this, that sometimes school funding can go too far. In fact, you use the term mission creep. What do you mean by this?
So that's not my opinion. Just to be clear, you know, the arguments that you hear a lot in school funding, generally from fiscal conservative circles, is that, you know, there's no clear correlation between school spending and student achievement. And why would we spend more money in a school district when there's no proof that it's going to improve things at all? And where the mission creep argument comes in specifically is when you look at, I think in our stories, I used it specifically in the context of Camden, where they got a big long-term increase, a big increase over many years, and saw very little student improvement. They saw some, but very little, really. But there's also a lot of money spent on really poverty interventions. It's what ed reporters know is the increasingly popular community school model, which actually seems to be doing a lot of good and good work and helping students in lots of different places. I think I use it as an example in my reporting a school I visited last year in Des Moines. You know, it has a food pantry. It has mental health services. I think it they were putting in a dental office in the school. And in our stories, we quoted a lawmaker from Indiana saying, look, you know, kids in poverty who, you know, show up to school hungry or, you know, whose parent was arrested the night before, I want to make sure I get the language right. He said, these kids exist outside the educational problem. His argument being that, you know, poverty is a problem, yes, but it's not a problem that schools can or should be obligated to fix. And I just think that's, It's just complicated because the fact is there are lots and lots of kids living in poverty in this country, a 1 in 5 kids. And the fact is, as superintendents in these districts will tell you, it is their problem. Kids will show up to class hungry. And if the school doesn't feed them, no one's going to. And they will sometimes show up cold. And if the school doesn't have a program to get them a jacket, no one else will. You know, kids will show up with a cavity. And if the school can't give them dental services, they might not get them otherwise. And it's just a really interesting question about what is the role of the school. And again, there are lots of folks who say, well, it's not to do these many things. And yet, there are lots of teachers and principals and superintendents who say, if we don't do them, no one will.
It's powerful. And I could talk about this all day, but I want to also talk about your process a little bit as well.
Sure.
As you mentioned before, this project was by no means a solo project. You collaborated with around 20 NPR member stations to tell this story. So how do you recruit so many reporters from across the country? And also, how do you manage so many different reporters to make sure that they're all telling stories of the same thread?
Yeah, that was the hardest part, frankly. Recruiting them was pretty easy because, again, as I said, from the beginning of the NPR Ed team more than 2 years ago, and I was brought in at the beginning of the team, my editor told me, he said, look, Corey, part of your job, because I'm both a reporter and an editor, and so part of my job as an editor was to really establish good, healthy, collaborative relationships with any ed reporter in the public radio system, you know, who wanted somebody to talk shop with. You know, it's not just that I've worked with some of these folks like Becky Vivi in Chicago or Tim Lloyd in St. Louis or Sarah in New Jersey. Like, I'm friends with them. I really love these people. when I came to them and said, I think this is what we want to do this year. You know, we did grad rates last year. We want to go bigger and get even more ambitious, and we want to do this. You know, frankly, I'd say at least half of them signed on immediately. They're like, yeah, we're in. Let's do it. The biggest challenge, really, along with my collaborator here on the Ed team, her name is Acacia Squires, she really helped me manage this unwieldy thing. I mean, I'm looking at it right now on the computer. We created a gigantic spreadsheet that has every reporter's phone number, email, a quick log line of their story. I mean, I spent hours with this spreadsheet. I actually at one point cut them all out into these little tiny strips of paper, and I just taped them on the wall and started rearranging them or clustering them to figure out, this is very early in the process, just to see, do I have too much overlap? You know, do I have too many stories that are basically rich school, poor school? You know, like Becky's story in Chicago about, you know, the school that spends $28,000 per child and the school that spends $9,000 per child. Like, I could have gotten that story from all 20 reporters, right? And I think for many of these reporters, that was their first inclination. Oh, this is what we should do. Yeah, I'll do that, and then I'll do that, and I'll do that. And the fact is, like, that's not nearly as interesting as one reporter giving me that. And another reporter, you know, like Jenny Brundine in Colorado, she gave me a very smart piece about state tax policy and the fact that at this really important moment, more than 20 years ago, the state capped property taxes and set limits on income tax revenue, and it had a dramatic effect on the state schools. And the state has essentially been trying ever since to figure out how to send more money to its schools without violating those changes to state law. You know, and again, we could have had a rich school, poor school story from Colorado, but that tax policy story was unique and really compelling in its own way. Or like the story we got out of Oregon, you know, that state many years ago shifted the burden of paying for schools away from property tax towards a statewide income tax. And, you know, even though we talk about how imbalanced a system is based on property tax, well, guess what? Oregon's system didn't work that well either. And that was just fascinating. Or like our story out of Mississippi gave us a really great opportunity to talk about imbalances in federal funding through Title I.
Aside from the stories, data also seems to have been really central to your reporting and your analysis. I'm curious, what kind of data did you use, and how did it work into your process?
The funny thing about the role of data in this is that we use data primarily to inform the map and to some of it shows up in some of the reporter stories, especially those sort of rich school, poor school comparisons. We knew we were going to provide readers and listeners with the map asset, and we knew that was going to be compelling. We knew they were going to want to look up local spending after it had been adjusted for regional cost differences, because otherwise, you know, it's apples to oranges.
Mm-hmm. Were there any moments, though, when you thought this issue was just too complex and you felt totally exasperated by it?
Every day. Yeah. Every day. Every damn day. This project was not easy. It was never easy, and there was never a moment. There was never a moment, even after the first week when the response was so overwhelmingly positive, there was never a moment when I thought we nailed it. Because, I mean, I'm looking at the spreadsheet right now, and it gives me a bit of a cold sweat. And it's done. Like, it's filled in. Every box has a check mark. You know, it's done. And I'm still looking at it and thinking, man, I wish I could have worked Florida in here. Or, you know, gosh, Minnesota would have been great. And the fact is, this is the challenge covering anything education-related in the U.S., from the national level anyway. You know, there are just so many really interesting patterns that are instructive, you know, common denominators, but you also have to allow for variation. And the only way to really do that is to go big or go home. And that's why we did it this way. You know, we had 20 different people in this thing. And so we allowed for that variation. We allowed for, you know, state-to-state differences. But hopefully, more than anything else, hopefully people who read the material, who heard the material, who engaged with the material, came away with two or three patterns that tie it all together. And for me, hopefully that's the success of the project, is that we found in this variation the moments where just about every state overlaps. You know, the stories of the kids who aren't getting what they need, and it's not in one place or two places or 10 places. It's in every state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just the way it is.
And so what kind of responses have you received from people who have looked at your series, from families or any stories that have come out after the initial reports?
Oh, yeah. The response has been amazing. So the project ended this past weekend, and I had to dedicate a whole day yesterday to just going through my email. Because as the project was ongoing, there was just too much work to do. I could barely even check my email. I mean, the long reads alone were 10,000 words total. And that's not accounting for the three radio things that I did, plus seven or eight radio pieces that we aired from my fellow reporters. And just, there's so much content. So yesterday I sat down with my 2,500 emails, and it was just, you know, great notes from so many different people in so many different places, from superintendents and parents and teachers, just concerned citizens. You know, some of them were just angry or frustrated, and some of them were actually really helpful. I got this great note from a student in Iowa who said that she had already, even before we began reporting on it, had already begun a student protest movement where she lived, because she and her fellow students, she said, were really frustrated by the fact that she knew her district was getting less money from the state to spend per student than other nearby districts, and they were protesting.
Wow. So ultimately, if your story was in some way a call out or even a wake-up call to parents or students or teachers or superintendents out there, you know, how do you think that people should be using this information that you're providing them in their lives?
Yeah. I don't know. I wish I had a really nice, neat answer for that. I don't. I sat at home for many, many, many hours working on the last paragraph of the last long read for week three, which was basically the end. Like, how do you end a thing, you know, that is 10,000 words and 20 reporters and, you know, and I was looking for quick fixes. I was looking for, well, keep these five things in mind. You know, I was aiming for a listicle, and the problem is this is not a listicle story. And what I ended up with was this really amazing piece of tape that our reporter Kate McGee sent me from Austin, Texas, of this veteran state lawmaker there, a Republican, who had fought for years to try and make the state's school spending system more equitable. And he said this really profound thing, or something that I found profound, which was basically, he said it on the State House floor, I think it was last May, so a year ago, and he's retiring now, and he said, you know, I'm paraphrasing, he said, talking to his fellow lawmakers, we got to stop thinking about kids in boxes. We got to stop thinking about black kids and white kids and poor kids and rich kids and kids in my district and kids in your district. And he said, we got to just start thinking about these kids as kids. And for me, the moment I heard that tape, it just took me back to what you and I were talking about earlier about the old deluder Satan law. You know, we got to start thinking about these kids as our kids, you know, as our collective obligation to kids, to everyone's kids, you know, and not just through some, for altruistic reasons, but it's about the health of the nation. It's about the health of the economy. Like, every kid deserves a fair shot and an adequate education. I don't think that's a partisan thing to say. I don't even think it's terribly controversial. I think what's controversial is that we have a system that doesn't necessarily guarantee that. And, you know, I got lots of notes from lots of people who were surprised to find out that the system doesn't necessarily guarantee that. You know, that the quality of your education varies wildly, depending on where you live, depending on the affluence of your community, you know, depending on the resources of your school.
Thank you again.
Awesome. Thank you, Annie. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. We'll be back next week.